Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we're speaking with Paul Brodsky, co-founder and co-managing member of QB Asset Management, who I finally met in person at the recent Casey Research Summit in Phoenix, Arizona. And I've invited Paul to speak on our program because of his years of experience as a bond trader, as well as his overall macroeconomic views, many of which are in agreement with the basic tenets of the crash course in my own writing. So Paul spent several decades trading bonds and other securities for such Wall Street firms as Drexel Burnham Lambert, Kidder Peabody, Spyglass Capital, where he actively managed mortgage-backed security derivative funds for over a decade. Now, it's important to note here that over 85% of investor capital in that last fund was returned by June 2006, before the wide-scale credit contraction. So Paul saw that coming and stepped out of the way. Well, welcome, Paul. It's a real pleasure to have you as our guest today. I'm really looking forward to discussing the bond market and its future with someone who has, I guess, an insider perspective.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's a great pleasure to be on with you. I'm a long fan, so it's a pleasure, and I'm flattered.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, before we dive into the bond market, can you give our listeners a brief overview of your macro outlook for markets and assets? You know, I found the views you presented at Casey to be quite in alignment with my own, but that's not why I'm asking. I think having your macro perspective helps set the stage here.
Sure. Given our background, my partner Lee Quaintance and I come from, as you mentioned, a heavy bond trading background, having run desks, government bond trading desks, and high yield trading desks for banks. And given that background, we tended to focus always on monetary policies and fiscal policies, as well as yield curves and volatilities and all these various arcane things that that most sane people don't like to look at in the markets. But given that, we came to the conclusion that fundamentally the credit markets were not sustainable. And we delved in further, we figured out, it took a while, but we figured out that credit and debt are obviously two sides of the same coin. This we knew for a while, but that when you look through them, what we're really talking about is the currency. And it became very clear to us that what we were looking at was a terrible currency problem at its core. And I'll be very brief about this, but the source of this whole thing, we think, was the tremendous growth in overnight systemic repurchase agreements from 1994, which took us out of the malaise in at that time, you may remember, all the way through 2006, where a monetary aggregate called M3, which was the only aggregate that that included repurchase agreements, which is the process by which banks fund themselves with each other, grew almost 12% a year. It's an enormous amount, and that basically tells you that this overnight lending among banks provided the fuel from which all of the term credit, or the 30-year mortgages ultimately, and auto loans, and revolving consumer credit that, of course, is never paid down, from whence that came. So, in effect, we knew that the system became highly susceptible to any hiccup, and that what we were looking at was an economy where, according to recent data, we've got $53 trillion in dollar-denominated claims, according to the Fed. I actually think it's higher than that, significantly higher than that, but let's just take their figure. On top of a $2.7 trillion in actual money, or M0, or to put it another way, currency in circulation plus bank reserves held at the Fed. So the system is levered at least 20 to 1, and there's effectively 20 times more debt than money with which to repay it. And so that's a long-winded way of setting the table for where we come down in our macro views. Clearly, it has great ramifications, negative ramifications for the currency. And given that the dollar is the world's reserve currency, we think it has significant ramifications for the global monetary system in general.
Right. So this is a story of leverage, which really began in the mid-90s. So this isn't any particular policy disaster that went off the rails in 2000 or even more recently than that. Interestingly, I've never connected this dot before between the overnights, the repos, and something else that really caught my eye in the mid-90s, actually was 94, 95, where the sweeps, I don't know if you know about the sweep programs, for the benefit of listeners who may not, what Greenspan did was he allowed banks to essentially dodge the reserve requirements by sweeping demand accounts. And what I mean by that is if you have money in a checking account that's yours to demand anytime you want, the banks have to hold a reserve against that, by law, 10%. But banks were allowed through this policy tweak that the Fed had done to effectively sweep that money out of that account just before the stroke of midnight, so that at midnight, when they take the snapshot and say, how much money do you have that you have to hold in a reserve against, they would sweep the money out of the way, the snapshot would be taken, look, there's no money, we get to hold very light reserves here, and then the money would get swept back in at, say, 1201. But during the snapshot period, whoops, it would disappear. That's where I had chased back, this credit bubble really got into high gear, and I thought it was due to the fact that banks were allowed to dodge these reserve requirements, effectively running leverage far, far higher. Does that connect to this story for you?
It does. It's all one and the same. We had a very, very loose bank regulator at the Fed. As a matter of fact, it looks as though everything was done so that banks could expand their balance sheets, which is ordinarily okay, nothing illegal about that, except what we have is a situation where not only through sweeps and repos and an expansion of commercial paper and various other things that allowed the banking system to expand, and the shadow banking system, by the way, to expand, a number of regulations made it very, very easy for bond buyers out there, institutional bond buyers, to continually take on more and more debt that was being securitized. But everything, it seems, all dovetailed very nicely so that banks and, on the buy side, bond buyers, portfolio managers, institutional money managers could grow their portfolios and take on a lot of that debt.
This all dovetails with all the things I was reading, that Greenspan was very much in love, I could say, with the idea that somehow risk had been eliminated, that we had become sophisticated enough, and through our ability to manage derivatives and other very complicated strategies, that risk had more or less been eliminated. So sure, go ahead, lever up. If we were at 10x before, go to 20x. No big deal, right? So now we're reaping the harvest from that particular sowing adventure. So here you were on the inside. You were watching this up close and personal. You were in the bond markets trading. So can you give our listeners a general primer on what a bond market really is? How does it work? I mean, when we say bond market, is it like a stock market? And if not, how is it different? How is it the same? What are we talking about when we say bond market?
Well, like anything, there's no simple answer. And at the risk of oversimplifying, which I'm happy to do, just to give a general overview, the bond market naturally is made up of many different markets, and there is no centralized exchange on which bonds trade. Let's first take a look at the government bond market, because that acts as obviously the benchmark for interest rates.
Yep.
And generally speaking, it's a very controlled, very systematic, very well defined primary market, meaning bonds are issued by Treasury through primary dealers. Generally, there are anywhere from 18 to 24 of them, depending on the environment and who's gone bankrupt and who's merged. But they're the largest banks. They're called primary dealers. And it's their obligation, if you will, but it's really been a very profitable business, so no one feels terribly obligated. But it's their obligation to bid at auctions. And auctions take place 3 or 4 days a week, usually, every week, and in the form of very short-term paper like bills and and rolling and so on and so forth to out all the way out the curve to longer term notes and ultimately to long bonds, which are auctioned less frequently. They tend to grab all the notice, of course. But every day there is a significant amount of secondary market trading that goes along after these auctions and during these auctions. The auctions occur by initially through an announcement by the Fed that they will auction X amount of bonds on this date. Then suddenly, immediately, primary dealers will begin trading in that when-issued security. They will short the notional security that hasn't yet been issued, and they will try to cover at the auction. And so during the when-issued period, which anywhere from a few days to a week before the actual auction, they will find a market for an interest rate, and obviously then they will try and cover at the auction. In the meantime, the sales force at the banks, the institutional bond sales force, will go out and solicit interest and from their institutional investors. And ultimately, they will find a parity at which, an interest rate parity at which these securities should trade. So the auctions tend to come off without too much of a hitch because everyone has already pretty much made a market in them. And they're pretty well known how much interest that there is going to be before the auctions are actually held. That pretty much defines the treasury market. Secondary market trading in treasuries is a very high volume, low margin business. It's very liquid. And of course, this keeps the benchmark interest rate curve off which all other tertiary bond markets trade. Now, other bond markets ranging from corporates and munis to high yield, of course, mortgage-backed securities, and then all the derivatives that trade based off of an interest rate or risk-free rates along the term structure or anywhere from overnight out to 30 years will trade off of the absolute yields in the Treasury, on the Treasury curve. So they will trade according to two things. One is, of course, their coupon, and the other is their risk of repayment. And for the most part, from here, I think everyone pretty much knows how bonds trade. Based on the perception of risk of repayment, they will, you know, trade back and forth in a day, and virtually all of the trading activity throughout all bond markets is done through voice by people on the phone, a buyer and a seller on a phone, and or maybe an intermediary making the exchange.
All done by voice. So how is it that we get these you go to Bloomberg and you check the Treasury curve and you're looking at the rates all out there. Are these there must be some electronic exchange for these as well, isn't there?
Well, there is. You don't see the inside markets that Treasury traders see at primary dealers. What you're seeing is a feed from brokers' brokers, one of the brokers' brokers that may have a contract with a vendor like Bloomberg to show the bid and offer sides of the Treasury market and the yields that accompany those prices. So you're not seeing the actual inside price, but frankly, they're very close, if not spot on.
Okay, so very big, very liquid market. There's an auction that goes off with some regularity, but it's a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday kind of thing. But every day we have this larger market trading. So I'm China. I've just developed a surplus. I decide I want to roll them into treasuries. Those are going to flow into my custody account at the Fed. Do I go through one of the primary dealers and make an offer and pick up some treasuries and then stash them over at the Fed? Is that how that works?
Yes. You may be China going through directly through one of the primaries or all of the primaries, or you may be doing it through an offshore account, or you may be doing it through a London subsidiary But yes, you would go through at auction. Everyone needs to go through the primaries. You can go direct to the Fed. Generally, it's typically not done because, or it's not done with regularity, because if that were to happen as a matter of course, your primaries, if you were the Fed, you want to keep a very good relationship with your primary dealers, and if there was a lot of trading done off market, if you will, they wouldn't be very pleased about that because they wouldn't know or feel as though they have as much control over pricing, and they would feel that they were taking too much risk.
Right. So the bond market, like any market, there's a bid and an offer or an ask. And if there are no bids, the prices are going down until we find a market clearing price that works. Of course, as the price of bonds goes down, yields go up. Is that so? In days when we see like the 10-year suddenly shoot up or gap down by say something big, 10 basis points, 15 basis points, which are each basis point being 0.01%. What's happening there? Is it just that the phones are ringing and there's just not enough bids, or are there too many bids and so we get those gaps?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
Nothing more complicated than that. Sometimes it's triggered by investors selling or buying. Sometimes it's triggered by the traders at the primary dealers choosing to lighten up or buy more of any specific issue.
Okay. So can you explain, you know, there were excesses and malincentives that created this big credit bubble. You might date it to 94. You might say that we've always sort of been in one since the decoupling from the gold standard. But at any rate, credit's been doubling and doubling again. And something that's quite mysterious to a lot of people is this idea that there were hundreds of billions, maybe trillions lost, certainly in the subprime, credit default swaps and the CDO piles. What happened there? I mean, who got fleeced? Who profited? Where did that money go?
Well, it's a complicated issue. Obviously, you had winners, and we all know who they are. And that came from credit default swaps, as you mentioned. And the losers on the other side were effectively the taxpayer, because the losers were ultimately bailed out, that being anyone that had subprimes on their books. Not all of them were bailed out. Obviously, real money, if you will, an institutional investor that held subprime loans in their portfolio, and these were pensioners and money managers that were investing in bonds on behalf of pension funds. If they happened to own subprime, then obviously they were big losers as well. So that's real money, that's real investment, and that's very real to people. So what some might have a problem with is any banks that held any of the subprime paper that were considered too big to fail, and as a result of this subprime paper being devalued naturally by the markets, created solvency questions on the part of banks. Clearly then that was an issue and government stepped in.
Right. So there were winners. They took their money, and then the losses ultimately are going to get borne somewhere. It's not like there was money that just sort of evaporated, and we didn't really allow a lot of debts to go bad. Some did. Lehman's did. Bear Stearns, some did of that. Of course, Fed took on a big chunk of those losses as well. But by and large, given the amount of dislocation we saw, the losses weren't truly recognized. Are those losses still lurking out there in your estimation at this point, or have they really been passed over to the taxpayer? And this doesn't have to be a U.S.-centric question. This could be a euro question right now.
No, I think debt is still probably marked too high on balance sheets, certainly at banks. And so I think it's still out there. It's still lurking. It doesn't necessarily have to be recognized ever, frankly, if the Fed produces enough inflation that takes them out in nominal terms, but it's still out there, and I would argue it's not only subprime, but as we're seeing now, it's turning into prime as well.
Okay.
So I would say bank balance sheets are extremely weak, weaker than is generally acknowledged, but it's tough to fight the too big to fail banking system because obviously they've got a very strong ally.
Right. So when I think back to 2008, that didn't surprise me a lot, what happened in October, because in September and in August, I was watching credit spreads start to widen out and blow out on all kinds, particularly on financial institutions. So there are these warning signs that come. I'm convinced that, I've warned my readers that the next major economic dislocation, a big one, most likely is going to be caused by a revolt in the bond market of some kind. And we talk about that a lot, and there hasn't been an honest-to-God, vigilante bond market revolt in quite a while. So some have perhaps ruled that out as a possibility. I think it's still in play. I'm wondering if you see the same dynamic possibly playing out, and then tell us what a bond market crash would look like. I think we just saw one in Greece. 1 year paper going off at 150% tells us something. To me, that's a crash. That's what one looks like. But do you share that view that such a thing could visit the U.S. eventually? And if so, what are the warning signs that give you just a little edge in this game?
Yeah, actually, I'm of two minds. We have not shorted bonds in our fund, even though we feel pretty strongly that if the market were to naturally determine interest rates, they would be much, much higher than where they are now, maybe even double digits.
Yeah.
In fact, probably double digits rather than 0 to 3% as they are. And the reason we haven't shorted them is because, frankly, a central bank, especially the Fed, has an infinite ability to create infinite amounts of money with which to buy debt.
Mm-hmm.
And they've shown a willingness to do that. And maybe it's our backgrounds, but we don't want to fight the Fed. On top of that, and that's just a worst-case scenario, if there's no bids for bonds, we're presuming they would step in and buy and be the buyer of last resort so that Treasury wouldn't go upside down. But even before that happens, most investors tend to put themselves in their own situations and tend to extrapolate that into a market. And that's not really the case, certainly in the bond market. Levered investors, those willing to borrow to buy bonds, have incentive still to borrow a lot to buy treasuries anywhere from 100 basis points or 1% to 2 to 3% and go out on the curve, because if they can borrow 10 or 20 times, and buy a 2% coupon, suddenly they're clipping a 20 or a 40% annual, income, and they know that they're on the side of the Fed, who doesn't want to let interest rates go higher, and their only incentive, frankly, is to get to the end of the year so they can take out a bonus.
Mm-hmm.
So economics is kind of taken leave, and the bond market, the treasury bond market, is no longer, we think, a true signal of interest rate, where they should be, or a true signal of inflation. And so it's an interest rate curve that has been distorted by terribly distorted incentives, as we see it. So we understand that. We don't think it's right. We'd rather have markets be free to adjust to where they should be. But frankly, we don't see that happening. To your question specifically about will we have that, and will we have something similar to what happened in Greece here in the U.S., we don't think we're ever going to get to that point here. And it's not because we're proud Americans and we think that the U.S. is better in every way than every foreign land. That's not the case at all. We think it's not going to happen here because if anything dire happens in terms of interest rates, like the threat of rising interest rates, as we understand it, the Fed's balance sheet is already levered 55 times. And if interest rates rise, we've heard between 40 and 50 basis points, it would make the Fed's balance sheet insolvent. So purely from an incentive standpoint, from obviously the central bank as well as levered bond buyers, which are the marginal price setters for benchmark interest rates, we don't see really a high probability that interest rates are going to go higher And taking a step back then, the situation is Greece, as you mentioned, you know, short-term interest rates are on the moon. We don't see that happening in the United States because we can print and monetize our treasury debt, whereas Greece cannot, and it's unclear that Germany is going to make the decision to do that. And so that's why you're seeing it. It's as though, you know, if California didn't have the printing press in Washington, a better example would be Ohio presently, you would see Ohio municipal bonds trading at 100% or higher. But obviously Ohio has the Fed in Washington willing to create dollars should something happen.
Okay,
they come under the bigger umbrella of the United States.
Yes, I agree. Don't fight the Fed is very sage advice, has always been. Suppose for the moment, though, that it somehow things do get away from the Fed. They find themselves following, not leading the market. It's happened to them before. Hasn't happened recently, but certainly that used to be the case. So I don't know. So there's all these people who have bond funds that are levered up 20 times, 10 times, some big giant number. And all of a sudden the rumor comes through the grapevine that China has decided enough is enough and they're quietly liquidating their custody account into whatever bids they can find. Wouldn't we find that those levered bond funds would potentially get caught in the equivalent of a long squeeze, in essence? I mean, they would have to get out there and start liquidating into this madness. Is that a possibility? Let's admit it's a possibility. How probable it is, another question. How do you think the Fed has, you know, with its infinite capability, can really step in and battle that?
Well, functionally, yes, they can, because again, if let's say China has $3 trillion in dollar reserves, just to pick a round number, yes, the Fed could print $5 trillion if they wanted to. They would always have more money than bonds outstanding, number one. And they could always assume anyone else's debt, because there's literally no limit. However, you bring up a very good point. If there's, for whatever reason, and by the way, let me tangentially say, I noticed a quote on today's Bloomberg from Hillary Clinton as State Department Secretary, saying something to the effect that to be in the State Department today, you have to be able to follow a Bloomberg screen as much as what's going on politically and diplomatically.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I say this because I think the problems that the Fed and U.S. Treasury is facing in terms of its debt is not only an economic problem or an economic issue. I think negotiations go deep and go wide, and obviously supporting U.S. Treasuries is something that I would argue has ramifications beyond just an economic decision in the Politburo in China.
Sure. Yeah, I'm national
having
security.
Having said all that, yes, of course it's a possibility. If they decide, if we anger them and for whatever reason and they decide as retribution or maybe it is an economic decision that they just don't want to own treasuries anymore and they decide to liquidate, I would suspect at that point you would see maybe even a formal devaluation of dollars. And we could go into that in a bit if you'd like, but I would think that's the point at which you would see, obviously the Fed would have to come in and buy a bunch and monetize a lot of debt. But my guess is that you would see, something more formal. And we'd go into a weekend and we'd come out of the weekend with a completely different new monetary system.
Okay, interesting. So where what I'm hearing here is a fairly simple story then. Had a very long, very protracted credit bubble. It ran up pretty hard. And the Fed has nearly infinite or probably infinite capability to just manufacture credit or what we call money out of thin air. All U.S. debt is denominated in U.S. dollars at this point in time, so there's really no external forcing function. So guess what? Printing can always happen. You started all of this by saying that when you peered through this landscape, what you saw was actually a currency risk. Let's go there for a second, if we could. How would that play out if it doesn't really play in a big bond market route? Something has to give in this story. You're saying it's the currency. What does that play out like?
I think the Fed is going to have to continue printing. They're going to go significant QE3 at some point. don't know exactly what form it'll take, but they're going to have to monetize debt. The process of doing that, as I'm sure your listeners know, it's when you buy debt, you print money with which to buy it, which moves new money out ostensibly into the system, but as we've seen, it only goes into banks as excess reserves. This process is the exact process of inflation. So if you print a dollar, you're diminishing the purchasing power of that dollar through dilution. And it's a very easy thing to understand. More dollars chasing, let's say, the same amount of goods and services and assets must drive the price level higher for those goods, services, and assets. And so what we see happening is through this process of money printing, we will have rising prices that rise much faster than wage growth or income growth, and it's going to make the ability to service debt that much harder. The point here is that they can make the appearance of growth happen by just printing money and raising the price level, yet real growth will contract at the same time. And to get your mind around this, I think the easiest way to think of this is, let's say last year I produced 4 widgets and I charged $2 a piece for each, and my output was $8.
Mm-hmm.
This year, after, say, the Fed prints a lot of money, I can charge $3 for my widgets, but I can only sell 3. Well, I had to fire a person who produced the widget. However, my output this year was $9 instead of last year's $8.
Mm-hmm.
So it looked as though we have output growth, and in nominal terms, we did. However, I had to fire someone who was a consumer and so on and so forth, and a taxpayer, and so the real economy actually shrunk while nominal growth rose. And so this is what has already been happening. The pressures, the fundamental economic pressures that build through this juggling act of trying to keep all the balls in the air by printing money and giving the appearance of growth and trying to instill confidence among consumers and among factors of production and among manufacturers and so on and so forth, it really can't last if there's no fundamental reason for it to continue. So, in reality, we think that they will print a lot of currency. The real economy will shrink. However, the good side of this whole thing, in an aggregate sense, and I'm not judging the merits or whether or not it's moral or anything along those lines, but since the U.S. and Western Europe and Japan, the great majority of our populations are indebted. By printing all this money, the prices will rise, and eventually even our wages will rise. But the only thing that won't rise is the amount we owe. And so this process of inflation reduces the burden of repaying debts, both in the private and the public sector, while it doesn't reduce the debt at all. But it does act as a deleveraging. You can delever either by letting credit deteriorate, and that has all terrible ramifications because you actually do have real contraction in the economy, or you can print money to meet the notional value of the debt. And those are the two ways to delever, and I think they're clearly going to print money, and that's the process of deleveraging they're going to take, thereby inflating away the burden of repaying the debt.
There's all kinds of reasons there's really no opposition to the idea of printing at the political sphere. They love it. Politicians tend to get tossed out during deflationary episodes. Inflation, they tend to hold their jobs. So there's a Jobs Creation Act for political people buried in there. And also, government can't tax deflation, meaning if I hold an asset like a house and it inflates 100%, some of that is taxable, depending on the size. Or any asset that inflates, that's a taxable moment. A deflating asset is not a taxable event. So you can't tax deflation. There's another reason we hate deflation, because it doesn't perpetuate the entire model of continued growth. But, you know, at some point in every credit bubble, and this has been true through all of history, and Reinhardt and Rogoff certainly proved that, at some point you just hit, you can't go any further. Even leaving aside that, you know, we might imagine there are natural resource pressures from peak oil or from other resources, or that there's natural limits being hit, forget about all that. There's always a moment when your credit bubble just can't go any further. There are no more noses that can fog mirrors that can take out a loan. How, in your estimate, you're looking at all of this, they've been pulling on the ripcord of the chainsaw as hard as they can, trying to get this thing started again. Have they? And if they can't, don't we just face some sort of deflationary outcome anyway?
I think before we ever get to a truly deflationary outcome, meaning output contraction, shall we say, the Fed will formally devalue the currency, which will solve all these problems. They can do it tomorrow if they chose.
Isn't everybody trying to devalue their currency?
Well, they would devalue it to gold, and not against the euro or not against the yen or the renminbi. That alternating currency devaluation tag team, whack-a-mole, beggar thy neighbor policy, works obviously for exporters, and it works in the very near term, but it really doesn't solve the problem, which is all of these currencies are baseless and are losing their purchasing power versus the goods with and services with inelastic demand properties, such as natural resources and things of scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes perfect sense that while they're trying to politically through policy devalue their currencies versus other fiat currencies, that's not a long-term solution. When I say devaluation, I mean against the currency that is scarce and that policymakers cannot manufacture. Because ultimately, it comes down to if I have a widget that I want to exchange for money, no matter where I am in the world, the money I want in exchange, I want to know that that's going to have, I want to have confidence in it that that's going to retain its purchasing power, and it'll get to the point ultimately where the one I'm going to want is something other than what you're offering. There is precedent, obviously, that gold has backed money, and we happen to think that that is the end game. Ultimately, you will see probably the Fed formally devalue the dollar versus gold after 40 years of it being untied, and that's all. I mean, this is just the pendulum swinging back, we think. And they'll do it at a price, a gold price in dollar terms, that will reflect the amount of past monetary inflation that we've seen.
Yikes!
Or something close to that.
That's a big number.
It's a big number. We think it's about little north of $10,000 currently.
Mm-hmm.
And. You know, it's a nice round, provocative number, but actually, it's not how we got there. We got there by using the old Bretton Woods model of taking monetary base and dividing it by official gold holdings.
Monetary
and that was
gold.
How we got to the $35 an ounce number for years and years and years from 1945 to 1971. When we went off the Bretton Woods model, and Nixon went off the gold standard, the gold exchange standard in 71, we have inflated the monetary base, and most of that has come just recently, and to the point where now an ounce of gold would be worth a little north of $10,000. And
right.
We think they've got a lot more to go, but it's going to be some big number. That's the point here when they ultimately formally devalue and then peg it.
And then peg it. So it's basically a return to a gold standard of a sort of some kind. And so that's a pretty big monetary event, obviously.
Well, it is. It's not as it's not. It right now it sounds terribly radical. in the sweep of a few generations, it's not that radical. Who would have thought, you know, as preposterous as that sounds today, in 1968, it probably would have sounded preposterous to think that we would not be on a gold exchange standard.
Yeah. Well, you couldn't have gotten me 5 years ago if you said, can the U.S. government run trillion-plus, trillion-and-a-half-dollar deficits for 3-4 years in a row, spending 40% more than they take in, I would have said no way. But here we are.
Here we are. And the issue now is one of leverage. We're so far over our skis that the driver, the economic driver has become, and decision-making among most all economic participants is, can I service my debt, rather than what do I want?
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, economic function begins to collapse. And I'm not saying that there's going to be suddenly a free market and we're going to go back to a utopian barter economy or anything like that. What I'm saying is the government will want to retain control. The only way they'll be able to do that is through going back, is devaluing. As they devalued it in 1971, the irony is they'll be going back to a gold standard or a quasi-gold standard. I think that the method that they'll do that, you know, they'll print a lot of money with which to tender gold at some big number, that will be highly inflationary. And then they'll probably make a market, target a gold price. As today, they target Fed funds and interest rate. They'll target a gold price. So, you know, we'll buy your gold at 10,000, we'll sell you our gold at 10,200, and if too many people tender, then, you know, they'll take the price down and vice versa. And what I think that would do, that's not a gold standard, by the way. That is maintaining a credit market in effect. However, it would still place a little more pressure on lenders to watch their backs in terms of the unreserved credit that they're carrying. And it would probably, more than anything, just instill confidence in dollar holders after the devaluation.
Yes.
That it would retain its value. We don't think they're going to go back, you know, they're going to go to a fully reserved lending system. We don't think that's in the cards. We think banks will still cheat and lend out much more than they have. They'll be able to inflate another day, but we think that there will probably be an event that attempts to push the reset button, which would instill confidence and probably, in all likelihood, be pretty stimulative for the economy. And we think that that's what it would be.
So that all fits and makes sense. So do you have any advice for the average retail investor looking to maybe not swing in for the fences, not looking for a lot of risk here, just looking to preserve purchasing power? I'm guessing gold fits into that for you. Is that the kind of landscape we're in right now? We're just seeking to simply hold on to what we have and while the dust settles?
Well, yeah, I think if you look at gold, it's and you start to think of it as a currency, which it is, and not as a commodity, a volatile commodity. All gold does, I think, is handicap the likelihood that there will be a deleveraging or a new monetary system. And at 250 an ounce, it was the market thought it was a very low likelihood. At 1600, it's a higher likelihood. You know, and if there is a reset in the currency, global currency regime, maybe gold becomes worth 10,000 or even more. Who knows? Or something, not even 10,000, whatever they can get away with. But it's some bigger number. So yes, in answer to your question, I would say gold it should be thought of as cash in the best currency. I would suggest anything scarce with inelastic demand properties. And that's how we get to energy and how we get to agriculture and various other things. They should be considered very strongly.
Okay, cool.
Things I would stay away from are over-levered assets that depend upon new credit issuance or new debt being assumed, I should say, to drive earnings.
Okay. And that's great advice. How about, so your fund at QB Asset Management, can you let our listeners know a little bit about that and where they can find out more about it if they're interested?
Well, It is a private fund for accredited investors only, so there's very little I can talk about.
Okay.
But I'm sure if anyone wants to talk to me about it, I can be reached at pbrodsky@qbamco.com. And I'd be happy to speak with anyone and correspond with anyone who might think that they're interested.
Okay. Well, fantastic. That's all the time we have today. I really want to thank you for your very clear explanations there. I hope we've really covered the bond market and let people know how it works, and also your views. Very interesting that don't fight the Fed. They're pretty big. They have a printing press. They're not afraid to use it. Count on it. And that's if I can sum it up thusly. So, hey, Paul, thanks a lot, and I really appreciate your time today.
You bet, Chris. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartenson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.